the concerning thing for me is, as I look at 2023, I think it's going to be almost impossible to avoid that recession.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. As we approach the end of 2022, which was one of the most tumultuous years for stocks and bonds in decades, investors are now turning their eye to 2023. Will it offer relief, perhaps recovery? Or will the bear market resume and bring asset prices to deeper lows? For insight, it helps to talk to those tasked with captaining client capital through the seas ahead. Today, we're fortunate to hear from Michael Green, Portfolio Manager and Chief Strategist at Simplify Asset Management. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Adam, it's a real pleasure.
Well, Mike, look, we're speaking the week after Thanksgiving. I hope you had a wonderful one. I'm going to just kick things off here real briefly. First, let me say I'm grateful to have you here on this channel just by yourself. You joined us in the summer for a really rollicking debate on whether or not, well, the role of central banking and whether or not we should even have central banks. You were taking the pro side versus Yaron Brooks of the Ayn Rand Institute, who was taking the con side. I felt you did a yeoman's job there. I know you had probably the less popular side, given the general slant of at least this macro audience, but you held it up really well. But let's jump into just getting to pick your brain for the full time here, Michael. Let me start with a question I like to ask all my guests right at the beginning. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
So I think, one, the global economy is clearly under stress from a combination of factors. Both the shutting down from COVID continues to reverberate in terms of its implications. That led to supply chain stresses. It led to significant changes in purchasing baskets, and particularly impacted areas of the world that had less surplus, effectively less reserves on which to tap. If you want to put it back in agricultural terms, they had less of a stock of seed corn on which to rely. And therefore, when the stresses came, they were forced more quickly into periods of truly fundamental stress. At the same time, we seem to have exacerbated those stresses through policy choices. And so the thing that I have been most vociferous on in the past year is the underlying dynamics of inflation and the Fed's response to that, or central bank's response to that. I feel somewhat alone in the underlying view, and it's particularly ironic after the Yaron Brooks conversation, that we have adopted uniquely poor policies, effectively interjecting volatility into an already stressed system by very, very rapidly trying to tighten financial conditions. And that has had the unintended effect of, in my view, accelerating many of the challenges that we could have potentially avoided. And so as I look to 2023, what worries me, you know, if I'm going to highlight one thing in particular, it's that 2022 has not been about recession. We've not seen the traditional dynamics associated with rising household financial stress. We've not seen it in terms of rising corporate stress. There's been modest widening in corporate credit spreads, for example, certainly relative to historical examples. But by and large, we've avoided the characteristics that have traditionally characterized a recession, in which we suddenly discover that X fraction of the population is, to quote Warren Buffett, swimming without bathing suits, right? That's the concerning thing for me is, as I look at 2023, I think it's going to be almost impossible to avoid that recession. And that suggests that what we've seen so far in 2022, among the worst bear markets in history, has largely been a byproduct of inappropriately tight monetary policy combined with some fiscal tightening that was a natural byproduct of rolling off of COVID stimulus. That's now likely to manifest itself as genuine financial stress and recession and economic condition stress in 2023. So that's you know, I'm concerned looking into 2023 that we are now facing a potentially very serious slowdown in a global economy that has far less, you know, in dating terms going for it than it has historically.
All right. Lots of great threads to pull on there. That's a great start there, Mike. Let's see here. Where to jump in? Why don't we start first on the policy side? So it sounds like you're not a fan. That was going to be my first question here is do you think the Fed's doing the right thing given the current environment? If I heard you correctly, it sounds like you're saying probably not. If it had just kind of left things alone, we might have let the system, given the system a chance to sort of stabilize more sufficiently from the shockwaves that it had felt. But now that we've been hammering it with all these rate hikes, really the fastest pace on record, as well as quantitative tightening, we're kind of keeping it continually on its heels and maybe in a way that makes it even more unstable. Is that true?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's right. And you know, this is the great irony is that many who opposed Fed intervention when it was tied to loosening of financial conditions, effectively perpetuating many of the financial risks that existed. And you know, if you remember, like I'm not necessarily a fan of an overly aggressive, actually I'm not at all a fan of an overly aggressive central bank, but I do think it's important to understand that part of the role of having a discretionary central bank is to provide relief under conditions that were unforeseeable. For example, shutting down the economy under COVID. That's very, so what we experienced with COVID is almost identical to what has happened in every historical pandemic. It is very similar to what has happened under most warlike conditions where the structure of the economy in terms of purchasing baskets, behaviors, allocation of resources, et cetera, has radically shifted. And when you come out of that period, right, you naturally see a recovery in consumer demand. You naturally see, I apologize for that. You naturally see a significant change in terms of the purchasing basket, and that creates inflationary conditions. It happened following World War I. It happened following World War II. And the right response to that is to facilitate that transition in an economy by keeping capital costs relatively low or at least stable, right? So what we need is the ability to scale up production of electric vehicles, to scale up production of copper, to increase US production as compared to relying on fragile supply chains based in China. Instead, we've chosen to penalize capital investment by rapidly raising the cost of rates and increasing the hurdle so that people are biased to go buy treasuries, right? They're more interested in funding the government than they are in funding private enterprise at this point. The only prior periods where we've done that, ironically, are exactly what Powell refers to, the Volcker era or the 1970s. In the period from 1918 basically through 1921, what Jim Grant refers to as the forgotten recession, the Fed largely left markets alone and allowed them to recover, right? That also had the Spanish flu associated with it, further increasing the parallels. In the 1940s, coming out of the World War II, we left borrowing costs unchanged, right? Facilitating the transition of factories from tanks to cars. In the 1970s, we chose to try to control prices. We chose to try to intervene. We chose to put actual price controls in place. We chose to raise interest rates to try to hike it. And what that prevented was the capital deepening that was necessary as we, one, changed the fundamental underpinnings of industrial production in the United States. Remember, going into the oil crisis in the 1970s, about a third of US industrial production relied on things like diesel generators for their power. Those immediately became uneconomic. What we needed to do was increase our investment to allow us to replace those. Unfortunately, you know, the control freaks at the Fed and in the administration decided to try to prevent unpopular things like price increases occurring. And it's just really hard because it's so frustrating to me that people who want hands off look at prices and immediately say, that's the Fed. When the reality is that's a signal that's being sent by the market, reallocate resources, right? It's just, it's so frustrating to me to hear people say, you know, oh, the inflation is caused by the Fed. No, the inflation was caused by shutting down the economy and then trying to restart it with a totally different purchasing basket. Right, that's what we saw over and over and over again. And the research on this is really clear. This was largely about a shift in relative prices as compared to a shift in absolute prices. Now, our decision to react to it likely has turned it into a permanent shift and a permanent interjection of volatility into the system that's going to make everyone poorer.
Okay. Just for folks that might not have followed the comment you just made there about the the difference in the types of price increases we've seen, can you just elaborate on that a little bit more?
Sure. So inflation in a truly monetary sense, right? The Milton Friedman, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, is the relationship in the equation MV equals PQ, right? The quantity of money times the velocity of money, how frequently it turns over, equals the price level times the quantity level. The monetarist view is if you increase the quantity of money and velocity remains unchanged, right, then prices by definition, you're not going to see a significant change in Q, quantity, therefore price levels rise. What we actually have largely experienced is a significant shift in relative prices. And relative prices are functionally, you go to the grocery store and suddenly the price of beef is twice as expensive as chicken, right? What would you do? You would substitute chicken for beef, right? And at the same time, if you really, really wanted beef, you would be sending a signal to the producers of beef to increase the quantities of beef that are available. Right, that change in relative prices is largely what underpins what we call the CPI, right? The consumer price index. Mm-hmm. This is one of these ridiculously technical dynamics. CPI is a fixed basket. Now, there's all sorts of criticisms that are leveled at it in terms of, you know, hedonic adjustments, which means quality adjustments, or measures like owner's equivalent rent, right, which attempts to link the price of homes to the equivalent of a consumption component as compared to an investment component. But one of the reasons we've seen such a huge divergence between CPI and the PCE deflator, the personal consumption deflator, is the personal consumption deflator actually takes what people are truly buying and uses that to establish a basket. So the basket allows substitution on a continuous basis. That has been so much lower than CPI, precisely because people are making relative allocations. They're choosing to fly less. They're choosing to double up in apartments now. They're choosing to send their kids to public school as compared to private school. They're choosing not to have kids, right? These are all stresses that are painful on the individual and collective basis, but are important in a capitalist society to send price signals to producers to change supply allocations.
Got it, right. And I mean, I think that those that are in favor of capital markets are in favor of those types of price signals, right? Because they're basically telling the economy where you need more supply and less supply.
Correct, that's exactly it. And it's, you know, again, what I find so perverse is those who are most against an activist Fed when the Fed was loosening under disastrous financial conditions. And I am the first person to admit that the Fed stayed loose for far too long, unfortunately for political reasons, or what appear to be largely political reasons. And the minute they reversed that, it also appears to have been largely political reasons, right? And so, you know, it just became unacceptable to have this level of inflation and not do anything. Well, if you're against an activist Fed, you should be against an activist Fed making a decision regardless in that framework.
Right. That's so interesting. And I find it interesting too, that everybody who said, don't fight the Fed, you know, for the past 12 years, as the Fed kept pumping liquidity into the markets and keeping interest rates at historic lows, and they rode that asset bubble up, they're all now bitching about, you know, the fact that the Fed isn't doing what they wanted to do, right? So they're trying to fight the Fed and still buy into this market. And of course, the Fed has been pushing markets. The Fed's actions have largely been pushing markets down this year. And it's so funny that the folks that have been clamoring, don't fight the Fed, are now actually the most ones pushing back on what the Fed is doing.
Well, you know, I mean, again, I just think that there's no intellectual honesty amongst thieves, right? And we're all thieves in one form or another. So, you know, when the Fed does what we want it to do, we applaud it. When the Fed doesn't do what we want it to do, then we, you know, lambast it. I try to be intellectually honest and say, look, if you're against intervention, you should be against intervention.
In both directions. Yeah. No, totally get it. So you get a couple questions about where things are headed, whether we like what the Fed is doing or not. But real quick, do you think the Fed's response, it sounds like you think the Fed intervened in the way that it should, given its mandate as a central bank during a crisis like the pandemic. But do you agree with what the Fed actually did, or would you have either had it done less or intervened in a different way?
I think that there's, first, the Fed's role in the pandemic was largely one of facilitation, right? So it enabled a lot of the actions that people wanted to do rather than drove those decisions. And I would just highlight things like mortgage rates, right? So what really happened, the Fed cut interest rates that led to mortgage rates falling by between 50 and 75 basis points, depending on how you want to think about it. That's remarkable, not in the context of the absolute change in interest rates, but because that occurred in an environment that people were actually even able to get mortgages in a period of 20% unemployment briefly, right? Mm-hmm. If you just think about the economic uncertainty and the unwillingness of traditional financial markets to extend credit under those conditions, it could have been a truly disastrous scenario, right? So what the Fed did was it said, look, people want to move out of the cities where they've been told that their roommates are poisonous and capable of killing them. This is consistent with every pandemic in history. We're simply going to make sure that they're able to access the credit to buy this as compared to a wholesale distress that would occur if, you know, 20% of the people lost their jobs, and it would have been far worse than that without the economic support. The flip side of that, and I want to fully acknowledge this, is the economic support was only necessary because the ridiculous policy of shutting down our economy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's absurd. That was the original sin. It had nothing to do with the Fed. It had everything to do with panic amongst the, you know, elite policymaking set. How much of that was a function of what we were told by China, right? Remember the videos that were coming to us from China that showed people collapsing on the streets and, yep, you know, dying, you know, standing, like, we saw nothing like that. Why was that transmitted to us? The only possible conclusion was that it was a psyop, right? That they basically were trying to scare the hell out of us. And they succeeded. We threw the policy book out, right? So now, having committed the ridiculous sin of closing down our entire economy, rather than pursuing the path that we know how to treat an infectious respiratory virus, we isolate those who are vulnerable, we protect them, and we basically tell other people to be thoughtful, right? We failed to do that completely. We shut the economy down. Now, once you've chosen to shut the economy down, if you don't choose to extend credit, like, then you get what you're seeing in China right now, right? Which is effectively a wholesale collapse and people being locked down and saying, when are we going to be let back out? When can we start beginning to live our lives, right? So I think what the Fed did was facilitate under very poor choice, under very poor conditions. Once it became clear that the fiscal response was there, and once it became clear that the credit uncertainties had largely been resolved, and we saw the extreme collapse in things like credit spreads, the Fed should have almost immediately begun withdrawing stimulus. First, in the form of purchasing securities like mortgages, et cetera. Secondly, by beginning to remove some of the stimulus and interest rates. And that's another problem that I have with the Fed's reaction function, is they seem incapable of saying, well, let's treat these two as different variables, right? Purchasing mm-hmm. securities and raising and lowering interest rates may have different effects. And we should probably at some point be thoughtful about doing one or the other, right? Now, within the Fed, the argument is, why would we want to press the brake and the gas at the same time? And anyone who's ever raced a car will tell you, well, there's lots of reasons why you might want to do that, right? Particularly if you're navigating a tricky turn, right? There's actually very specific situations in which you want to do exactly that. And I would just largely argue that, you know, we're trying to, quote unquote, professionally manage the economy, something we really shouldn't be able to do, and we should acknowledge that. And then we're failing to use the tools appropriately when they're available to us.
Okay. All right. And let's move on to what you think is most probable to happen from here. And again, it's not an endorsement of what's going on. It's just you're looking through your lens, you've got to manage capital. And so you're assessing the probabilities ahead from here. While it sounds like you would have liked for the Fed to have just paused after easing, as opposed to pivoting to hiking and tightening now, the Fed is hiking and tightening. And Jerome Powell, if we can take him at his word, is saying, I'm not done yet. We'll be hiking in the next year. How high do you think rates are going to go? You know, Powell's kind of guiding us to a 5.25 range in the federal funds rate. Do you think he will get there? And one of the reasons why I asked that question is we've had a number of people on this program who are skeptical of him being able to get there because, quote unquote, something's going to break first.
Yeah, unfortunately, and I mean, I put out a note this morning that highlighted some of these same dynamics. Look, the behavior we're seeing in financial markets is very similar to what transpired in the global financial crisis, where people forget that, you know, basically through September, through the beginning part of September, this was largely a normal recession and slowdown, and then something really broke, right? You know, we allowed Lehman Brothers to fail under the moral hazard framework, and that sent the world into paroxysms, right? Spasms. I honestly believe we're setting up something similar here.
Okay. And what would be some of your top candidates for, you know, a domino that could really start that kind of contagion?
Well, for me, the you know, really important dominoes continue to be things like passive investment products, right? So largely through this whole year, we have not seen significant selling of passive products by retail. We've seen tremendous amounts of selling by professional investors who have lowered their discretionary exposure in everything ranging from volatility products, risk parity products, balanced portfolios like target date funds, et cetera. Those have all contributed to the behavior that I think that we're seeing, but we have not yet seen retail basically say, okay, I'm out, right? My fear would be if we get to the point that we start to see rising unemployment, that the positive impulse that comes through things like contributions to retirement accounts turns into a modest outflow that then becomes a far more distressed situation.
Okay. Okay, let me just interject here. So this is a topic that's come up several times of late. I like to credit Bill Fleckenstein because he was one of the first to raise it on this channel, and he makes it really understandable. He calls it the giant mindless robot.
Yeah.
And, you know, as money capital flows into these passive investing vehicles, and these are, you know, lots of ETFs and whatnot, it's allocated by a simple, you know, formula, right? That says, hey, this ETF holds these stocks in, you know, these ratios. And so when capital goes in, forced buying in those stocks has to happen according to the formula, right?
Yep.
And he's basically said, you know, that can, you know, like a rising tide, it can cover a lot of fundamental, contradictory fundamental trends, as long as that tide is strong enough to overpower them. And that explains in many cases why, you know, a lot of the indices, they had companies inside them that fell much more than the indices themselves, but the indices were propped up by the big market cap companies that this capital tends to flow into because of this dynamic. And so he said, hey, if that ever does shift into reverse, you know, then we can get into a lot of trouble here, because just as these things have disproportionately supported prices as capital has inflowed, when capital outflows, it's going to disproportionately drag everything down with it. Is that more or less what you're talking about here?
To a certain extent. So I've spent a lot of time talking with Bill about this dynamic, and I would argue that directionally he has that correct. So there's two or three separate components associated with that argument. The first is the overall role of passive or systematic investment strategies, right? And I'm separating those two. So a passive investment strategy is one that tries to mimic an index like the S&P 500 or the Vanguard Total Market Index. The actual underlying benchmark there is what's called the CRSP index. That's also used by players like BlackRock, et cetera, for their total market indices. And that actually, I think, is a more important index in many ways than the S&P 500. But the overlap is incredible, right? So, you know, 95% of the market cap of the Vanguard Total Market Index is actually the S&P 500. I think it's like 93% now. when money flows into something like a Vanguard Total Market ETF or mutual fund. So VTI is the ticker of Vanguard's Total Market ETF. VTSMX is one of several classes of their total market mutual fund. Those tend to be the default investments in many 401ks, IRAs, target date funds, and as an underlying component, et cetera. And those operate on the world's simplest principle. Did you give me cash? If so, then buy. Did you ask for cash? If so, then sell. All right. Like that's the entire methodology. Mm-hmm. It is presumed that liquidity scales with market cap. We know that is untrue. It's also presumed that the impact of the flows into those investment vehicles should be negligible because they're quote unquote passive and simply reflecting the behavior of all the other portfolio managers, right? But that's not true. If you actually go back and you look at the underlying theory behind passive investing, Bill Sharpe's 1991 paper, The Arithmetic of Active Management, outlines why passive managers are expected to outperform. And the definition he uses of passive managers is somebody who never buys or sells, someone who never transacts. Well, if you're Vanguard or BlackRock and you're, or State Street or Geode or any of the other Northern Trust, any of the other passive players out there, and there are lots and lots and lots of them, passive penetration is far greater than most people think it is. You are transacting, right? So you can't be passive. Instead, all you're doing is the same thing that a whole bunch of other people are doing, right? That would work if markets were highly elastic. In other words, money coming in and out didn't change prices, but we know that's not true, right? And we actually have academic evidence that has been released starting in 2020 that highlights just how untrue that is. The efficient market hypothesis, which underpins all the theories behind passive investing, the idea that the market fully reflects all available information, and therefore by simply passively mirroring what everyone else has done, you're capturing the best available information in the market. That model presumes that markets are highly elastic, meaning prices don't change that much when new supply and demand emerges. The actual specification under the efficient market hypothesis is roughly that a dollar into the market causes less than 1%, I'm sorry, 0.01% change, right? So a 1% increase in flows causes 0.01%. In other words, a dollar coming in causes a 1 cent increase in market cap.
Right. So negligible.
Negligible, right? The actual data suggests that that number is somewhere between $5 and $17. Right. In other words, the efficient market hypothesis is misspecified by at least 500 to one. Right. That is not even close enough for government work. And yet we allowed this these strategies to become in excess of 40% of the U.S. equity markets and well in excess now of 25% of our bond markets, our fixed income markets. So we've just allowed an absolute travesty in terms of the growth of passive investing. All right, and this has very fundamentally changed the underlying behavior in markets.
All right, let me just pause for a second and ground things here for folks that are more novice right investors.
Now. Yeah.
But it sounds like you're saying, hey, the assumption that money flowing in or out of these passive vehicles doesn't really impact prices all that much because the markets are so efficient is wrong. It actually distorts prices. I'm guessing it distorts prices in the direction that the capital is flowing, right? There's a lot of arguments out there that we have blown an asset price bubble. Some of that's because there's so much liquidity sloshing around. Some of that, to what we said earlier just a few minutes ago, is that capital gets unfairly pushed into big companies that supports their prices, drives their prices up, but also it drives the overall indices up because they make up so much of the indice. You're now saying, well, here's yet another factor, which is that money flowing in actually has a disproportionately distortive effect in the direction that the capital is flowing here. And now that it's become such a massive part of our capital markets, we have allowed the camel to not only get its nose under the tent, but like get its entire, hump underneath there. And
let's just pushing everything up. Let's make it really simple. The camel is sleeping with your wife.
Okay. Campbell has not only pushed you out of the tent, it's taken over your role with your spouse. Okay, right. Got it. All right. So, all right. Well, that's a, so I'm looking at the clock here. We're going to get a lot packed in here, Mike, but you're challenging me by, you keep bringing in these great topics that I feel like we could spend the entire time talking about here. So two questions on this topic: what to do about it? And, you know, even if you have a good idea of what we should do about it, doesn't mean we are going to do it. What's the risk here, and how do you think this plays out? You know, in other words, you said you think a recession's kind of due for next year. Does that also, and we'll get into your market outlook in a bit, but does it also mean that you think some sort of big price correction is due at some point because of all this deformation?
So unfortunately, I think that we could get corrections in both ways, right? So, and I'll send you a chart that shows this. So, you know, my argument of what has transpired on a year-to-date basis is that this is almost entirely due to the Fed. Once the Fed began to indicate that they were going to withdraw, that they were going to begin to hike interest rates, that has a very particular effect when you have dominant strategies like systematic rebalancing, target date funds, et cetera, that automatically rebalance between equities and bonds. And that is different. Again, it's really important for people to understand that these types of rebalancing strategies are relatively new innovations, things like risk parity, target date funds, et cetera, are relatively new innovations that have not previously played a significant role in the market. And now you have a condition in place in which an external actor, the Fed, can meaningfully and directly impact the valuation and price of an asset class like bonds, right? So by raising interest rates, they're mechanically forcing bond prices lower. If I have a portfolio that is mechanically, right, again, that word, rebalanced between bonds and equities, if bonds go down in price, what do I have to do to equities? I have to sell equities, buy bonds.
Right.
Right. So I sell equities, I buy bonds. The Fed then forces the prices of bonds lower again. I sell equities, I buy bonds. The Fed then forces prices of bonds lower. I sell equities, I buy bonds. That is exactly the pattern that we have observed this year, where the relationship between the total bond index that's used in things like target date funds and the total equity indices that I referred to earlier has been almost perfectly and totally flat. And you can directly tie that to when the Fed changed its indication, right? So the minute the market began to price in that the Fed was going to begin raising interest rates, equity markets and bond markets began to fall, right? It's just that straightforward.
All right. Well, so back to my earlier question then. So we have, I don't put words in your mouth, but we can have some degree of confidence that interest rates are going to continue higher in the short term, right? Because that's what Powell said.
And what we've seen in this last rally, right? And it's, of course, being reversed right now with Jim Bullard. Today's November 28th, day, you know, the Monday after Thanksgiving, right? Jim Bullard predictably is out saying interest rates are going to have to go even higher because financial conditions have improved so much, a rally in equities and a lowering in bond spreads since the last Fed hike, right? The rumors of the pivot, Lael Brainard going out and saying, maybe we're a little closer, et cetera, trying to effectively sow dissent to position herself to take over for Jay Powell when he gets fired, right? So we're actually setting up conditions under which the Fed is going to have to be much harder and harsher, or at least believes that they should be, because they have a very fundamentally flawed model of what they're trying to accomplish.
Got it. Yeah. And this to me, again, it's so interesting. There's the combination of the fight between the Fed, Jerome Powell, and everybody that cheered his actions up until now, right?
Yep.
You know, nobody wanted to fight the Fed, and now everybody wants to fight the Fed, and they keep trying to anticipate his pivot, and then the markets go up, and then he's going to play even more hardball, right?
Yep.
And at the same time, you have kind of a Game of Thrones going on within the Fed, right? Which you just gave nod to there, which is, you know, Powell is probably the most hawkish member of the Fed right now, and his vote is the one that counts at the end of the day. But you have a lot of his, you know, lieutenants there that are actively trying to sort of stab him in the back, it seems.
Yeah, no, I think that's correct.
Yeah.
Jim Bullard positioning himself to try to be, you know, the Xi choice, the choice down the middle when Lael flames out and Powell flames out. It's okay. Like, and it's absurd to watch. It's you know, it's eye candy for those with political theory as a focus in markets. And for those of us that are more focused on the underlying macroeconomics, this is just horrifying to watch.
Yeah, well, and it's also super dangerous, right? It's like listening to the pilot, the co-pilot, and the navigator, you know, argue in the cockpit of the plane that's flying you, right? And they all have different opinions on how they want the plane to fly. It's not confidence inspiring.
It is not confidence inspiring. And I believe that it was, I'm blanking on his name. This is what happens when you get older. The German prime minister, you know, you never want to watch sausage being made or policy choices being made, right? You know, and so we're unfortunately exposed in the world of social media and endless communications to, you know, these individuals who honestly should be locked away in a room and not allowed to speak to the public. They're increasingly treated as celebrities.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, so let's get down to brass tacks then in terms of what we think all this means. I really like having guys like you on the program, Mike, not only because you're very smart, obviously, but you manage capital, right? So you just can't afford to just sort of have an opinion and put it out there. And if you're wrong, hey, no worries. You actually have to put, you know, your client's capital behind your convictions here. So you said earlier that you think that the probability of possibility of a recession next year is pretty high. You've raised your concerns about current Fed policy. You think it's too much given the weakness of the system. You've just given us some issues about why you're concerned about asset prices in the markets. I'm sure we could talk a lot more about that, but you named a pretty big one there with these passive vehicles. So as you look forward into next year, what do you see as most likely probable if a recession, a material one? Will it be short-lived, like the almost blink and you miss it one we had back in 2020, or will this one be more prolonged?
So I think that's really hard to know, obviously, right? Predictions are hard, especially about the future. So I would say two things. First, I agree with your guess that ultimately I think the Fed is going to break something and that we will likely not see the Fed be able to achieve its terminal goal. That is complicated, as I said, by the political dynamics within the Fed, where Jerome Powell is more committed to us thinking of him as Volcker, and more importantly, what he imagines Paul Volcker to have been, having not directly experienced Paul Volcker. Or that time period, or frankly, shown the intellectual curiosity to really explore it. He largely has felt betrayed by his research staff, who assured him that inflation was transitory, which increasingly it's looking like it actually was. And by the way, I just want to emphasize for people, when economists or financial market participants talk about transitory inflation, they aren't talking about the price level, they're talking about the change in the price level, right? So substantive changes occurred during the pandemic and in global trading regimes and in supply chains, et cetera, that are likely to translate to higher nominal prices for many of the things that you buy, right? So food prices and home prices, et cetera. Those could remain at higher levels than they have historically for a variety of reasons, all of which we could spend 2 hours talking about in detail, right? But what we're referring to is the rate of price change, right? So the rate of price change is slowing very rapidly and appears to be heading negative in many categories and is likely to turn negative in categories that matter to debt markets. I think that's actually really important. Commercial real estate would be one of the obvious examples there.
Okay, and sorry to interrupt, but just real quick. So it sounds like what you're saying is the era of inflation now is ending, maybe even over. We're now, for at least some period of time, in an era of disinflation.
I think disinflation and possibly deflation in 2023. Now, of course, as I was saying before, I think the Fed's policy choices have injected volatility into that. So we could very well see inflation rise at the tail end of 2023 or into 2024 as the Fed responds, right? So we've taken what was a relatively stable system and we have made it unstable.
Yeah, which, I mean, I think there are lots of people who could make the argument is that's what happens every time you intervene. Right.
Yeah, that's exactly the point, right? Which is, you know, if you're going to be against intervention, you should allow those price signals to percolate through and allow the market to make those hard choices rather than an unelected cabal of 12 individuals.
Yeah. Okay. So I get, and look, Mike, I commit to having you back on the program whenever you want to come on in the future to give us audibles as things are going on here.
Yeah.
So I know I'm asking you to pontificate.
Yeah, no, I understand. Okay. So yeah. Let's just frame it in terms of how I've positioned the portfolios that I manage, which is, one, I'm underweight equities going into 2023. In particular, I'm underweight smaller cap, more cyclically exposed equities. I would highlight sectors like energy, et cetera, that have captured the public imagination, have actually received disproportionate flows. The concept that oil prices or gas prices could fall is largely beyond their remit, right? They've just have focused on the supply side, said demand is largely constant and inelastic, and everything we're seeing suggests that is fundamentally not true, right? That we're actually seeing a relatively high degree of elasticity in those. I'd highlight things like gasoline demand in the United States is now down 5% year over year. Right. So like those are huge changes in those markets.
Right.
And really, I'm just curious to emphasize how big that is.
Yeah. Right. I'm just curious real quick on that. Is how much of that do you think is high prices curing high prices, which is people are changing behavior because things have got so expensive? And how much of that is, Jerome Powell's demand destruction, which is I'm just doing everything I can to make the consumer have to tighten their belt.
Yeah. I think very little of it has to do with Jerome Powell. Until very recently, like we're just beginning to see, like we just remember there's long and variable lags, right? So the Fed didn't begin hiking until March. The minimum estimate of those lags is somewhere around 6 months, right? So it's just now, we haven't seen unemployment begin to rise in any meaningful way. We're just now starting to see layoffs rise. We're just now beginning to cope with the reality that wages are unlikely to rise as much as people had been expecting, right? And so all of that is flowing through the system now.
All right. So let's talk about that for a second. Then I do want to get back to your outlook and your allocations. So I talk about this a lot on the program, which is this delay between the Fed pulling a lever and then it actually fully manifesting in the economy. And as we've mentioned about 30 minutes ago, the Fed has hiked at a faster pace than ever in the data set, right? So we've got this bolus of impact from the rate hikes that have been made so far this year that hasn't fully arrived yet, right? So even if the Fed stops today, that is still going to slam into us, right? And then, of course, the Fed is continuing to make hikes. So it sounds like you are saying that's going to be pretty material, folks. Like you said, we're just beginning to feel it now. My sense is what you're saying, Mike, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that's going to play a sizable role going forward over the next couple of quarters in pushing things down in a disinflationary, potentially deflationary way.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the points, and I wrote a piece on this on my Medium profile. I'm happy to provide a link to you, highlighting that the Fed's models of how interest rates affect economies, that effectively they are trying to slow consumption. There is not a valid empirical model on the planet that says that's how it works. What happens is the Fed slows investment, right? And so what we're seeing already is every CFO out there is saying, you know what, if we can delay making that investment choice, we're going to delay it. Home builders, if we can delay building that next house, we're going to delay it. The only thing that's kept us alive in 2022 has been the fact that the delays that were in the production channel meant that things like construction remained elevated up until now. Now we're beginning to see homes under construction plummet.
Okay.
Right? So let's
tug at that specifically, which is the housing market, right? So we have exactly what you're talking about hitting right there, right? At the same time, you know, we've had mortgage rates that are, you know, up around 7%, right? For a 30-year fixed, I think in California, where you and I both live, it's more like around 8%. That's almost a tripling from where they were, 15 months ago or so, right? Yeah. I mean, that's just like crypto. So I guess first question is what's your outlook for the housing market next year? Is it anything other than disastrous, given that?
I think it's really hard to treat it as anything other than disastrous on two fronts. Right. So, you know, again, like, let's go back to the global financial crisis for a second. And I mentioned this dynamic of homes under construction. Again, I'll send you a chart of this so you can share it with your listeners.
Great. And by the way, the article you mentioned a few minutes ago, like a minute or two ago, send it to me. And folks, well, I'll put a link to that in the description under this video so you can go read it.
So if I look at total homes under construction in the United States, it hit an all-time high in October, right? 1.74 million, a level that really we had not seen even under the housing bubble in 2006, right? That is largely, that didn't really accelerate and take off until 2021 because of the delays in the system. A price signal went out, as it does in every pandemic, that people wanted to move out of cities, obtain more housing. You move from having roommates to suddenly those roommates could kill you. Therefore, you wanted to have fewer roommates, right? And so you moved into a single family home, or you took your family to the relative safety of the suburbs, or you picked up and moved and left your home in California where they shut schools. And exactly as my sister did, moved to Nashville, Tennessee, because they still had schools open and she wanted to make sure her children were properly educated, right? So all of this caused, as it has in every pandemic, a shifting in human populations that results in the need for more construction. That was going to naturally unwind as that demand retreated. Instead, we've chosen to basically stab the market, you know, repeatedly in a violent fashion by tripling interest rates. And the delays in the system mean that's only now going to start to hit. Right? Like, that's really important for people to understand. We have not yet seen the pain.
Right. And so one of the things I say in this channel a lot is that what happens in the real estate market to prices has a much larger negative wealth effect than what happens in the stock market, because financial assets, they are not as proportionally owned. You know, it's really the top, I think it's like top 10% that owns like 90% of all financial asset wealth out there.
A little
there.
Misleading, but yes, you're directionally correct, right? Homes are okay. By far the vast majority of people's assets.
Yeah. So just from a psyche, right? And of course, consumer spending is about 70% of GDP, right? So when the housing market gets really whacked, you would expect that to force people to tighten their belts more than what's happening in the stock markets. Secondly, in this environment we're talking about where, you know, consumer spending is going down, people are feeling less wealthy. Obviously, the impacts that you're talking about from the Fed policy tightening and stuff like that is going to be, it's going to contribute to margin compression for corporations. And therefore, my point is you start getting layoffs, right? And that's my next question for you, which is how bad do you think the layoff part of this recession could be? And if it's material, then that begins to add to the downward vortex in consumer spending, right? Because nothing makes people rein in their spending than losing their income or fear of losing their income.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So,
and let me toss on one more wrinkle, right? Which is, unlike the global financial crisis, and this is where it gets more complicated, right? So in the global financial crisis, it was largely a function of the massively inappropriate extension of credit, right? So you had people who were given home ownership who never should have been given home ownership. The story you hear in The Big Short about the Fed hiking interest rates, that's just not what actually happened. What actually happened was first payment defaults. People who never should have bought homes were basically engaged in fraud, right? Whether they did it intentionally or whether somebody did it for them on their behalf, right? That was what really drove The Big Short. And part of the evidence for that was how quickly home prices recovered, right? It really wasn't the dynamics that people think it was. This time around, by and large, homes are owned by people who can afford to own them as they currently exist. But what that actually means, unfortunately, is that we're unlikely to see the same level of distressed home sales and flexibility that creates, where people are able to move to new locations, either because, and as painful as this sounds, they went bankrupt, lost their home, and therefore moved to a place where they could get a new job. Mm-hmm. Right now, you're seeing a market that is likely to be stuck almost in like quick drying cement, right? People will do everything they can to avoid taking that loss on their home because it's pure equity at this point. Just like people refuse to sell .com stocks, even as they fell 98% in some situations.
Yeah. So let me just toss a question out there. So there's a lot of homes right now that are held by boomers, mm-hmm. right? And for a good number of them, that home equity is in their, has in their mind kind of been their retirement fund.
Absolutely. Right?
So is there the potential as home prices begin to soften? And look, you know, I always try to remind people that home prices are, you know, houses are priced at the margin, right? You don't need that many transactions in that neighborhood for your home price to get affected, right? So is there the potential for, you know, folks to panic and say, hey, look, it looks like houses are softening. I'm going to lower my price by 10% and sell out now because it's a lot better to get 90% of what I was counting on than hold for too long and end up with a lot less, right?
So I unfortunately, I think that's correct. And I do think that that is ultimately what will drive home prices meaningfully lower is job losses and people that are forced to monetize, right? They're forced to crystallize those losses. I often point out to people that, you know, the price history that we see in markets is not really what people think it is. It's not information. It's actually transactions. Mm-hmm. The forced transactions can behave exactly as you're describing. Now, the flip side of that is that I don't think we're going to see the same types of inventory explosion that we saw in the global financial crisis. We're not yep. going to see the same level of bank-owned homes where the, you know, bank-owned homes are simply dumped because the banks just don't, that's not their business, right? Homeowners are in the business of owning homes. And so what we're much more likely to end up with is a situation that looks like Italy. And this is a theme I've talked about for a long time, right? Italy has remarkably high levels of home ownership. This is part of what leads to the ridiculous claims that Italy is wealthier than Germany. Germany has high levels of rental, right? What really happens in Italy is, you know, on Adam, what were housing starts in Italy last year?
I'm going to guess pretty low.
Nobody knows because nobody cares because it's completely irrelevant. Right. And so you end up in a situation in which basically those children of the baby boomers are going to find themselves unable to find homes to buy. And so they're going to stay with their parents and they're going to make the same choices that you make in Italy, which is one child lives with the family until the parents die, then they inherit the home. And guess what? They're rich on paper, even as they can't move to get a new job.
Yeah.
Right. So we're driving stasis in our economy, making it far less dynamic than it otherwise would be.
Okay. That's a great macro point. One minor point on this is, I think you made a good point. I just want to restate and see if you agree with me, which is, we may not see the flood of inventory, right, of transactions turnover that we saw in the wake of the 08 crisis. And I think a lot of people think, oh, well, then good. Then that means prices aren't going to come down very much. And my warning is no, prices can still come down a lot, even on low turnover because of this margin impact.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think the risk of people losing their homes in the same way
is lower.
Much lower.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, you know, if you're watching this, folks, and, you know, you got a 3% mortgage and you have no plans to move for the next decade plus or whatever, I wouldn't sweat it too much. But, you know, if that's not the case, or even if you do, you know, it's not 100% certainty. Stuff just happens, right? Life happens. People die. People get divorced. People lose their jobs unexpectedly, you know, whatever. All right. Look, there's so many questions I have for you, Mike. We're just obviously going to have you on at some other point to go into this. I want to ask you two last macro questions, and it's unfair because they're big questions and so big topics. So
we'll cover them quickly. Yes.
Go yeah. Ahead. Just give me your high level thoughts, and then we'll just earmark to have you back on again. And then I want to do return. We'll close with your market outlook, and again maybe a little more detail on some of the choices you're making in the portfolio. First, China. And I wouldn't try to tack it into the end of a discussion like this, except I saw that you had posted something on your Twitter that was interesting to me, because so many people are looking to China as a bullish trigger at some point in 2023, which is, hey, eventually it's going to, you know, emerge from its COVID lockdown. The world's going to get a surge of demand, and that's going to be bullish for markets and whatnot. And that still could happen. Absolutely. But two things. One, you were looking at global growth estimates, and I think one was like around copper. And you were saying, hey, just note that a lot of that projection is coming from China. And so sort of where China goes is going to have a real disproportionate impact on you know, global growth outlooks from here. And the implication I took from that was, hey, if China doesn't do as well as people are hoping, that really could impact global growth forecasts for next year. And then, of course, kind of going into this weekend and over the weekend, we've seen the surprise eruption of really strong civil unrest in China, a very uncharacteristic pushback to President Xi's policies there right now. Some people are saying, well, a lot of China watchers are saying this is the worst they've seen since Tiananmen. I don't know if it's at the Tiananmen level yet, and who knows what's going to happen. The world's going to watch pretty quickly. But how much of a monkey wrench does this throw into the, you know, China as a bullish trigger camp's outlook here?
Well, I mean, look, I just think the bullish case on China is ridiculous.
Our interview with Mike will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And remember, we're continuing our new practice of publishing my top takeaways from these weekly interviews. To get mine from this interview with Mike for free, just go to wealthion.com/AdamsNotes. And finally, if the challenging macro outlook that Mike has detailed in this interview has you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no strings attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends and risks that Mike's mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next in part two of our interview with Mike Green.